We are now 7 billion humans jostling together on the planet. And it's often said that we have a triple imperative. First, to find out if we have reason enough to know that there's a dignity and worth to every last one of us. Secondly, to know if we can discover how to live with our deepest differences, especially when those differences are religious and ideological. And thirdly, to discover whether we can settle our debates and our deliberations through reasoned persuasion and not through force. Now, I want to argue that the deepest answer to that is a rediscovery of soul freedom for everybody. Now, that is Roger Williams' term for the freedom of conscience, thought, and religion that Article 18 of the Universal Declaration defends, and that the Americans in their Constitution called free exercise. But let me just raise a number of questions which set out this argument. First, why has this become an issue today? Well, on the one hand, we are living in a world in which everyone is now everywhere, as it's put. Travel, migration, the media. We're suddenly aware of the extraordinary exploding diversity of our time. And it's not just people with little private religious preferences, but entire worldviews and entire ways of life, elbow to elbow with other entire worldviews and other entire ways of life, often in the same society. So how we live with our differences has become urgent worldwide. At the same time, many of our traditional settlements for settling this, the ways we handle religion and public life, have collapsed. And you can see in many, particularly our Western countries, culture warring over the place of religion in all sorts of ways. But thirdly, you can see the emergence of what's called a global public square. We have gone from the Greek Agora and the Latin Forum to the place where in our democratic societies, the public square is not only the Houses of Parliament, the French Assembly, the American Congress, but everywhere where public life is discussed, the op-ed pages of the newspaper and so on. But now, in the age of the internet, the public square is going virtual. And you can see in the responses, say, to the Danish cartoon controversy, even when someone is not speaking to the world, they can be heard by the world and the world can organize its responses. And we need to figure out how we live with our differences in this real but very rudimentary global public square. So the issue of living with differences is more urgent than ever before and one of the keys to the human future. Secondly, let me raise the question, isn't this approach just another recipe for culture warring and endlessly futile? Certainly we have culture wars today, but one of the reasons is that people are defending religious liberty in ways that are not appropriate to it. For example, many people argue for their own rights and not the rights of the common good. A journalist said to me back in the 1980s, looking at the Christian right, they talk of justice, but what they really mean is just us. Now, if you think a right for one is a right for another and a responsibility for both. So a right for a Christian is a right for a Jew and a right for an atheist and a right for a Mormon and a right for every faith within the country that we're talking about. Now, that's certainly an extension of the so-called golden rule which Jesus taught and you find in many of the world's religions. And we need to rediscover the reciprocity and the mutuality of rights so that our rights are always best protected when we fight for the rights of others, and especially when the smallest communities and the most unpopular communities know that their rights are defended, then ours will be well guarded too. Another problem of the way people are fighting it today is that they're answering all the violations through law rather than what Alexis de Tocqueville called the habits of the heart. It's always been understood that freedom's guaranteed not only by the structures of law, but by the spirit living in the citizens. 30 years ago, one of the leaders of the ACLU said to me, "We will always win for a simple reason. We have more lawyers than anyone else." That was then. Today, you have liberal lawyers, conservative lawyers. Liberal defense funds, conservative defense funds. Massive liberal litigation, massive conservative litigation. And the net effect is a mounting litigiousness and a deepening bitterness in the culture war. And the fact is, we will never solve the problems through law alone. Law is precious and essential. But it's only when the matters of freedom live in the hearts of everyone that freedom is truly well guaranteed. A third big question. What are the options for the models of religion in public life? We have essentially two dueling extremes. On the one hand, those who believe in a sacred public square, where one religion is established or a monopoly, and everyone else is somewhat marginalized, which in a diverse society is increasingly unjust and unworkable. You can have mild examples of it, for example, the Church of England in England. No one's persecuted. You can have very severe examples of it, for instance, Saudi Arabia. At the other extreme, you have what's called the naked public square, where all religions are systematically excluded with an antiseptic cleansing. Now that, of course, is even more unjust and even more unworkable, because most people in the world are religious, whatever their religion is. And you can see that secularism, which favors that position, is then semi-established by default. Of course, you can have moderate versions, for example, French laïcité, or you can have extreme versions, for example, the People's Republic of China and all the heavy persecutions they've brought. The alternative is what's called a civil public square, a vision of public life in which everyone of every faith is free to enter and engage public life on the basis of their faith. That's freedom of conscience. But, here's the big but, within a politically agreed and handed down framework of what is just and free for everybody else too. Now that notion of civility, or a civil public square, is surrounded with all sorts of misunderstandings today. First, some people think civility is niceness. We've all got to be nice to each other because we're squeamish about the differences. No. Civility is a classical virtue and a classical duty. It's a republican virtue, with a small r, a democratic duty with a small d. In other words, it's the way that citizens know the value of their own position, but know how to negotiate the differences of others civilly in a diverse society. The second misunderstanding, and this is very important to people like we Christians who take our faith seriously, civility is not a search for a lowest common denominator unity. It is not the goal of interfaith dialogue. The simple fact is that the religious and ideological differences today and always are irreducible and ultimate, and let's pretend nothing else. There is no common core unity. Rather, civility is a framework in which we can debate and persuade and hopefully prevail in democratic arguments, each faith taking their own faith seriously. It is the freedom to be faithful and yet to know how to live with the differences of others peacefully rather than violently or coercively. The third misunderstanding of civility is that it's a form of moral indifference. If we respect people's right to believe something, we have to, quote, tolerate all their belief and all their behavior. No. Put it like this. The right to believe anything does not mean that anything anyone believes is right. The first half of that sentence is freedom of conscience. Our Lord does not want coerced obedience or love. He allows us to respond to him freely, even to reject him. And we respect the right of everyone to believe what they believe based on the dictates of their conscience. The right to believe anything is absolute. But the idea that anything anyone believes is right is plain nonsense. People may believe things that are intellectually muddled, that are socially disastrous, or worse still, are morally profoundly evil. So we respect their right to believe, but we also have the right and the responsibility to engage with them if we believe that their beliefs coming out into behavior are disastrous or wrong for the rest of us. And this is not a form of moral indifference. Toleration is not actually the best word, because toleration is always concession and condescension, the powerful tolerating the weak, the majority tolerating the minority, the government tolerating the individual citizens. That's wrong. No, it's a matter of respect for freedom of conscience, but with civility, the freedom and responsibility to engage. One last question. How do we see something like civility in a civil public square brought into practical reality today? If you look at the Universal Declaration of Human Rights, we have a useful preference. Or many of the declarations down through history, from the Magna Carta onwards. There are three phases. First, declaration. That is always a matter of principles. The Universal Declaration has nothing in it that's binding legally. It's setting out 31 articles of freedom. The second stage is implementation, when it's legally brought into law and the nation's constitutions, which has happened with many of the nations of the world today. But the trouble is, many have stopped with those two stages, declaration, implementation. The third stage is the crucial one, civic education. It has to become a habit of the heart, as I said, passed on from parents to children, teachers to students, one generation to the next generation, so that citizens know what it means to live free. Now, it always used to be understood that in free societies, everybody's born free, not everybody's capable of freedom and worthy of freedom. They have to be, quote, educated for liberty, or liberal education, or civic education. And in many of our countries today, certainly in Western Europe and in North America, that is the missing element. We cannot trust law alone. It has to be taught so it's a habit of the heart through positive civic education restored to our societies again. Now, in finishing, do I believe in a one-size-fits-all settlement? No. Different countries with their different histories, different values, will have different settlements of religion and public life. But I would argue that whatever the diversity of the settlement, everyone should have a growing sphere of civility. In other words, an acknowledgement of soul freedom, freedom of conscience, thought, and religion for people of all faiths and none within the wider settlement in which they're living. Second closing question, is this realistic? Now, if you look at the world, we have some countries like the United States, which have wrestled with religious freedom for more than 200 years and have achieved more than any other society. They should take the lead today, but unfortunately, America is deeply admired in its culture warring. Western Europe, we've never had the development of religious freedom, although the ideas that flowered in America were actually sown in countries like England in the 17th century. They've never flowered here, though. Obviously, we've got parts of the world like the Middle East and presently China, where they're a long, long way back. I think either Europe or the United States needs to take the lead in recovering these things in a global dimension today. Alexis de Tocqueville made a very interesting remark towards the end of his life. He, of course, was a great admirer of the American Revolution and its emphasis on freedom, and he was a disappointed lover in his own country's French Revolution. But after musing on the comparison between them, towards the end of his life, he said this, "In a revolution, as with a novel, the hard part to invent is the ending. If you look at the history of religious freedom, there have been glorious chapters, many of the early ones written by strong Christians like Roger Williams and many others in the 17th century. There have been egregious chapters written, but we're in an extraordinary stage for the world where these issues are now global. And I think it's the expression of our Christian faith, as well as in the interests of our Christian faith, that Christians come into the forefront of standing for religious liberty for people of all faiths and none, and working out what this means for the human future. If we continue to do this badly, as we're currently doing, it will spell global chaos for mankind. If we begin to get this right, it could be one more factor that contributes constructively towards a genuine global civilization. And my hope is that we will join with people of all faiths who recognize the importance of the issue and who understand the principle of religious freedom for people of all faiths and none, so that together we can work out how we live with our deepest differences and so help to make the world genuinely safer for diversity and freedom. Thank you.